Hello, it's time to read the Des Moines Register for today, National Marching Band Day, which is March 4th. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of Iowans with a print disability. My name is Rachel Mithelman, and my partner at the microphone for the next 90 minutes is Cecilia Benetti. For the first hour, we'll cover local and national news from the Des Moines Register and USA Today. Our second hour starts with birthdays and obituaries, followed by opinions, sports, and lifestyle news. We'll wrap up our broadcast with Dear Abby. Support for today's reading comes from the Des Moines Register and donations from individuals and listeners like you. Learn how you can keep the volunteer voices of IRIS going strong at iowaradioreading.org. Now let's take a look at the weather and the headlines from today's Des Moines Register. Today, the high is to be 60 and the low of 36, clouds and sun, some passing showers. About the same tomorrow, and then cooling off this week. Wednesday, high of 56. Thursday, high of 52. Friday, high of 46. And then Saturday, 52. Sunday, 45. And a mix of rain, clouds, and sunshine this week. Now here is Cecilia with our first story.
At the very top of the page, the caption is legendary. Hawkeye star Caitlin Clark passes Pete Maravich's NCAA Division I scoring record in Iowa's victory over Ohio State. University of Iowa basketball star Caitlin Clark reacts after passing Pete Maravich's NCAA Division I career scoring record Sunday at Carver Hawkeye Arena in Iowa City. Clark and the Hawkeyes beat Ohio State 93-83 on Senior Day, Clark's final regular season game at Carver. The Dowling Catholic High School alum led Iowa with 35 points in the victory and eclipsed Maravich's mark of 3,667 points when she hit a pair of free throws before halftime. Iowa clinched a number 2 seed in this week's Big Ten tournament. There will be more on this story and the NCAA tournament when the sports is read later this morning. I'll move on to the next article, and that one is, it says, Iowa poll, a Register exclusive. 49% oppose birth certificate change for trans Iowans. More Iowans oppose than favor Governor Kim Reynolds' plan to require transgender Iowans' birth certificates to designate both their sex at birth and their current gender identity, a new Des Moines Register MediaCom Iowa poll finds. Reynolds, a Republican, drew widespread condemnation from LGBTQ advocacy groups when she introduced House File 2389 in February. The bill also would define man and woman in state law and make it easier for the state to exclude transgender women from women's bathrooms and other facilities. Critics have described it as erasure of transgender and non-binary Iowans, while Reynolds calls the bill a woman's bill of rights. The bill has passed a committee in the Iowa House, but it has not been taken up by the full chamber. The Iowa poll asked Iowans if they favor or oppose the effort to require transgender Iowans' birth certificates to include both their sex at birth and their current gender identity. The poll found 49% of Iowa adults oppose the proposal, while 44% favor it. Another 7% are not sure. The poll of 804 Iowa adults was conducted February 25 through the 28th by Salzer and Company. It has a margin of error of plus or minus 3.5 percentage points. The poll shows a partisan divide in how Iowans view the issue. half of self-identified Republicans, 50%, said they favor the proposal, compared to 42% who oppose it. Only a third of Democrats, 33%, favor the idea, compared to nearly two-thirds, or 63%, who oppose it. Political independents are closely divided, with slightly more saying they are opposed, 48%, than in favor, 45%. Lucy Giel, a 62-year-old Democratic poll respondent who lives near Burlington, opposes the idea. She said lawmakers should focus on more pressing issues like water quality and rising cancer rates. I feel like there are so many issues that our legislators could and should be working on that they're ignoring so that they can pick on LGBTQ people and minorities of all kinds, she said. Giel, a retired teacher who works as a math tutor, said she sees the bill as part of an agenda by Reynolds to bully transgender Iowans. Why would you require that other than to bully those people? She said, I feel like that's her whole agenda, to marginalize those people more than they already are. Reynolds and Iowa Republicans have enacted a slew of bills in recent years, placing restrictions on LGBTQ Iowans. In 2022, the governor signed a law banning transgender women and girls from participating in women's sports. Last year, the state passed restrictions on which bathrooms transgender students can use at school, prohibitions on teaching about sexual orientation or gender identity from kindergarten through sixth grade, and a ban on gender-affirming medical care for transgender youth under the age of 18. Jim Philman, a 67-year-old retired Republican poll respondent from Cascade, said he favors the new birth certificate requirement. It doesn't make sense that somebody can change their gender because they choose to, he said. There's boys and there's girls, and that's the way God made us, Philman added. Reynolds' bill says that for the purposes of state law, the term sex means someone's biological sex assigned at birth. It includes definition of male and female. A female is a person whose biological reproductive system is developed to produce ova, and a male is a person whose biological reproductive system is developed to fertilize the ova of a female, the bill states. The bill says that the term equal does not mean same or identical, and that separate accommodations are not inherently unequal. That language would allow the state to exclude transgender women from women's facilities, including bathrooms, locker rooms, women's prisons, domestic violence shelters, and rape crisis shelters. Transgender Iowans seeking a new birth certificate after a gender transition would be required to note their sex at birth in addition to their current identity. A new certificate of birth following a change in sex designation shall include a designation of the sex of the person as male or female, both at the time of birth and at the time the new certificate of birth is established, the bill states. And then here's a little side note about the poll. The Iowa poll conducted February 25 through 28, 2024, for the Des Moines Register and MediaCom by Seltzer and Company of Des Moines is based on telephone interviews from 804 Iowans ages 18 or older. Interviewers with Quantel Research contacted households with randomly selected landline and cell phone numbers supplied by Donata. Interviews were administered in English. Responses were adjusted by age, sex, and congressional district to reflect the general population based on recent American Community Survey estimates. Questions based on the sample of 804 Iowa adults have a maximum margin of error of plus or minus 3.5 percentage points. That means that if this survey were repeated during the same question, using the same questions and the same methodology, 19 times out of 20, the findings would not vary from the true population value by more than plus or minus 3.5 percentage points. Results based on smaller samples of respondents, such as the gender or age, have a larger margin of error. republishing or the copyright Iowa poll without credit and or digital platforms, links to originating content on the Des Moines Register and MediaCom is prohibited.
Moving to the Metro and Iowa section, Windsor Heights seeks sidewalk cash. City aiming to make 73rd Street safer. This is by Philip Sitter of the Register. A main road that connects Windsor Heights to West Des Moines has longstanding safety issues that Windsor Heights officials hope the federal government will pay to fix. The stretch of 73rd Street between Buffalo Road and Center Street does not have sidewalks from just south of the Starbucks to the intersection of Center and 8th. That means pedestrians have no built crossing across Norfolk Southern train tracks, no paved path alongside the road, and no designated crossings across on and off ramps for Interstate 235. It's also a busy area for pedestrians that includes a Walmart, Sam's Club, Walnut Creek YMCA, the nearby Dowling Catholic High School, and a Des Moines area regional transit stop that the system's chief planning officer attested to the U.S. Department of Transportation is the busiest outside of downtown Des Moines. City boundaries with Clive also meet in the same area, and the Clive Greenbelt Trail passes through along Walnut Creek. And there are problems for drivers, too. According to Windsor Heights city documents, the railroad crossing does not have gate arms, and some warning lights that had been damaged are missing. There aren't enough street lamps. The roadway itself is in poor condition, and the curve at the railroad crossing is too tight and lacks proper median design. The result of some of those problems can be seen in crash data, according to city documents. Crash rates there from 2013 to 2022 were 15% higher than the statewide rate on city streets and more than double the overall statewide average for all roads. Statewide data only was available from 2013 to 2016. The city applied for a federal Rebuilding American Infrastructure with Sustainability and Equity grant in 2023 to pay for $14.1 million of a nearly $17.7 million project there. It wants to add an 8-foot-wide sidewalk and accompanying concrete barrier on the east side of 73rd Street, addressing the issues at the curve and train crossing, resurface the road from Center Street to University Avenue, and realign two of the Interstate 235 ramps in order to get rid of a weaving lane and accommodate the sidewalk. Windsor Heights was not awarded a RAISE grant in 2023, but the Windsor Heights City Council on February 19th approved recommitting funding for its grant match and submitting another application, according to city documents. The estimated cost for the project and the city's match has not changed. If approved, construction could begin in spring 2028 and be done by winter of 2030. The project also is among those currently being considered for other federal transportation funding through the Des Moines Area Metropolitan Planning Organization. Des Moines Area MPO is collecting public feedback online through March 8th on a total of 26 projects in the metro. Windsor Heights is requesting $2 million in federal surface transportation grant funding for the 73rd Street project and a total of $4 million over 3 years for the project through Des Moines Area MPO. Windsor Heights has been wanting to install a sidewalk in the area since the year 2000, but the road has limited right-of-way, and the railroad has been unwilling to provide property or easements, according to city documents. the city has found a new design to accommodate the railroad's right-of-way. The other main connection between Windsor Heights and West Des Moines is the 63rd Street Bridge over I-235. Officials believe by improving 73rd, traffic may lessen on 63rd, according to the project description on the MPO's website. Again, that article is by Philip Sitter, who focuses for the Des Moines Register on reporting on suburban growth and development in the western metro areas.
High-rise proposes residential conversion. Financial Center seeks to add 190 units on 15 floors. The Financial Center, a 25-story skyscraper that once stood as downtown Des Moines' tallest, could soon convert more than half its floors to residential use. The Des Moines City Council is poised at its meeting Monday to extend the deadlines of a development agreement dating from 2020 with the building's owner, Lawmark Capital Incorporated. Lawmark had previously proposed converting part of the building into a hotel. Under an amendment to the agreement, construction would begin on or before September 30th and be completed by the end of April 2026. That would give Lawmark time to meet the application deadline for historic tax credits. Lawmark's original proposal called for converting the first 13 floors of the building for the upscale hotel. As market conditions for the development of hotels changed over the course of the COVID-19 pandemic, city records state so did the project. Now the plan calls for 15 floors of multifamily housing in the 666 Walnut Street building. The conversion would bring 190 units with a mix of studios, one-bedroom, and two-bedroom units. A restaurant and cafe is planned for the ground floor with additional micro commercial space along 7th Street, which the building faces on the west. City staff expect future amendments to the agreement to update its financing structure, possibly resulting in more incentives for the project. In a communication to city council members, they said they intend to negotiate for a portion of the incentivized housing units to be provided at more affordable rates and restricted to households earning 80% or less of the area median income. Terms of the 2020 agreement included a 15-year tax increment finance package totaling $7.5 million. The Financial Center, completed in 1973, was the tallest building in the state until the completion of the Rouen Center in 1975. It is currently the fourth tallest on the downtown skyline. Lawmark Capital bought the building in 2014. Mark Bulzuik, a member of the Canadian investment team, told the Des Moines Register in 2020 that 70% of the Financial Center was vacant. City records show that the building's valuations peaked in 2007 at $23.4 million and has been steadily declining since. A Walgreens located on building's ground floor closed in February after 30 years there. The Financial Center building is just the latest conversion in a downtown plagued with an elevated office vacancy rate since 2020 when COVID-19 resulted in many people working from home. CBRE, a leading Iowa commercial brokerage firm, put the downtown office vacancy rate at 17.3% at the end of 2023, an increase from 16.2% in the previous quarter. Meanwhile, downtown Des Moines' residential population, including the East Village, has increased rapidly. The 2020 U.S. Census indicated it had grown 83% to 8,371 from 2010 to 2020, and more recent estimates put it close to 12,000. Developers in September announced plans to convert to Rouen Center, a landmark Des Moines office building for more than 40 years, to residential use. The 14-story building at 601 Locust Street will offer what the developers describe as 20 market-rate apartments by 2025 or 2026. Project partners Block Real Estate Services and Fauch Brothers also led the redevelopment of the Equitable Building directly across Locust Street from 2 Ruan into multifamily housing in 2016. Fauch Brothers participated in the multifamily conversion of the nearby Des Moines building as well.
Chevron blames Biden EPA for Iowa and Wisconsin plant closures, this by Danelle Eller of the Register. Blaming the Biden administration for difficult market conditions, an Ames company is closing its biodiesel plant in west central Iowa, laying off 24 workers. Chevron Renewable Energy Group is indefinitely idling its biodiesel plants in Ralston and Madison, Wisconsin, Neville Fernandez, a Chevron vice president, said Thursday. The plants have been shuttered since December, given economic conditions that have become very harsh, Fernandez says. Fernandez blamed the federal government for the biodiesel industry profit squeeze and the plant's closure. Under the Federal Renewable Fuel Standard, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency establishes how much biodiesel, ethanol, and other renewable fuel must be blended into the nation's fuel supply. The 2005 mandate is intended to reduce U.S. greenhouse gas emissions and support production of domestically made fuel derived from corn, soybeans, and other farm products. Critics last year said the EPA set the 2023 to 2025 blending requirements for biodiesel and other biomass-based fuel too low, failing to capitalize on renewable fuels' ability to cut emissions that contribute to climate change. For example, biodiesel and renewable diesel made using soybean oil, used cooking oil, fats and other feedstock produces about 70% fewer greenhouse gas emissions than standard diesel on average, and ethanol produces 46% fewer than standard gasoline, studies shows. While the EPA increased the biomass-based fuel blending requirements for 2023, it was about 1 billion gallons below what the industry produced, Fernandez says. That caused an imbalance in supply and demand, he said, and as a result, credits tied to biodiesel production have dropped about 70%. Grant Kimberly, Iowa Biodiesel Board Executive Director, said the group hadn't heard of other Iowa biodiesel plants planning to close. However, this possibility has been a concern, he said in an email. He continued, the industry warned EPA about this when it set the RFS renewable volume obligations well under our overall capacity, hurting the bottom line of biofuel plants. Fernandez said the industry will lobby the EPA this year to increase biodiesel blending requirements. With improved profit margins, the Ralston and Madison plants could reopen, he said. Until then, Fernandez said Chevron will seek to reemploy the plant's workers, including 26 in Wisconsin, at other facilities. The company has two other biodiesel plants in Newton and Mason City. It will offer severance benefits to workers unable to find jobs within the company, Fernandez said. California-based Chevron, which reported about $21.4 billion in earnings last year, purchased the Renewable Energy Group in 2022 for $3.15 billion. The Ralston plant, which can produce 30 million gallons annually, opened in 2002 and was the first biodiesel plant for the Renewable Energy Group. The company spent $32 million expanding and upgrading the plant, completing the work in 2018. Iowa is the largest U.S. producer of biodiesel, making 350 million gallons in 2023. It's the biggest ethanol producer at 4.6 billion gallons last year, the Iowa Renewable Fuels Association reported in February. Suzanne Sherbrone, Iowa Soybean Association board president, said the plant closings come as farmers are struggling to lock in profits this year with rising costs and falling crop prices. She said low biodiesel sales further put the farm economy at risk. Sherbrone is a northeast Iowa farmer. A strong Iowa biodiesel market helps farmers weather difficult economic times, she said. By increasing soybean oil value, biodiesel supports 13% of the per bushel price soybeans.
Mixed-use project proposed in Altoona. A plan is on the table to develop a slice of busy central Altoona with hundreds of new apartments. The Altoona Planning and Zoning Commission heard a proposal Tuesday from BTW Companies, LLC, to rezone 4 acres near the intersection of 8th Street Southwest and 5th Avenue Southwest, east of the Dollar General. The rezoning would allow for a proposed mixed-use development that could include a 5-story building with a first-floor retail space and 20 apartments above, studios, 1 bedrooms, and 2 bedrooms, alongside a courtyard area, parking spaces, and a separate commercial building, according to information presented at the meeting. The property currently has 4 small houses. The proposed project would appear to replace the houses according to initial site plans. It also would include buffering from other surrounding properties in the neighborhood. There have been no official decisions. The Planning Commission deferred a vote on the rezoning of the city and developer continue to hash out the details, including on parking layout. City officials would need to approve the rezoning and site plan for the proposed project to move forward, and further details are to be announced. Significant nearby developments and amenities include the library and the area with Center Place Lofts, Hy-Vee, and Civic Plaza. The proposed project would be blocks away from Altoona's historic Old Town neighborhood, which is also seeing redevelopment efforts such as a new mural and pocket park. And here's a little short article to finish up this Metro in Iowa section of the paper today. Man gets 60 years for child porn charges. An Eastern Iowa man was sentenced to serve 60 years in federal prison Tuesday for producing, receiving, and possessing child pornography. According to a news release from the U.S. Department of Justice, Christopher Douglas Black, age 45, was first arrested in connection with a missing child case from 2021. Following Black's arrest, a forensic review of Black's cell phone was conducted and revealed child sexual assault materials, the release states. Following his sentence, Black will be required to serve 10 years of supervised release. The case was investigated by the FBI and prosecuted by the United States Attorney's Office for the Southern District of Iowa. Black has appealed his sentencing.
Turning to national news now from the front section of the paper, student loan firm accused of avoiding calls. This is by Zachary Shermaley of USA Today. A top teachers union and an advocacy group for student loan borrowers are turning up the heat on one of the country's biggest student loan companies. The American Federation of Teachers and the Student Borrower Protection Center are accusing the company of mismanaging a key student loan program for public service workers and engaging in a call deflection scheme by strategically avoiding borrowers who need help. The groups this week released a trove of internal documents obtained through public information laws from the Missouri Higher Education Loan Authority, or acronym-wise, MOHELA. The student loan company or servicer works with borrowers nationwide. We have ample evidence to show that something rotten is happening in Missouri, said Mike Pierce, the executive director of the Student Borrower Protection Center. The company is calling the accusations false, disingenuous, and nothing more than a PR campaign. A Mohela spokesperson said in a statement to USA Today on Thursday, "It is unfortunate and irresponsible that information is being spun to create a false narrative in an attempt to mislead the public. Mohela remains committed to helping the millions of student loan borrowers that we serve." The back and forth escalates the fraught relationship between student loan companies and key Democratic constituencies who continue to pressure the federal government to dismantle the student loan system. Meanwhile, the Biden administration is relying on companies like Mohela to help carry out signature debt relief policies in an election year where student loan forgiveness is already playing a big role. The 47-page report published Wednesday provides a glimpse into how one of the country's biggest student loan providers handled the return of bills this fall. Overall, jumpstarting the student loan system after the pandemic has been far from simple. A major percentage of borrowers did not pay their bills at all when they first came due. The report suggests Mohela failed these borrowers by confusing them with a Byzantine loop of misinformation and false promises when they called to ask for help. The company's critics say the end goal was to keep borrowers from getting their problems resolved, which would save Mohela money. The Education Department said the Biden administration has made clear it won't let borrowers pay for the failures of student loan companies. In October, the feds issued a $7.2 million penalty to Mohela for failing to send millions of borrowers their bills on time when payments resumed. There are two big allegations the advocacy groups are making. The first involves the Public Service Loan Forgiveness, or PSLF, program. The federal policy allows student loan borrowers who work in public service-oriented jobs, teachers or government employees, for example, to have their loans fully canceled if they've spent a decade responsibly paying them down. Mohela facilitates student loans for all PSLF borrowers. The report says Mohela has profited from a backlog in PSLF applications that the company allowed to explode, with nearly 1 million unprocessed forms awaiting officials' attention. It says servicers incorrectly told some borrowers they didn't qualify for the program and inaccurately counted the payments borrowers made to be eligible for full relief. In a joint statement this week, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, Democrat of New York, and Senator Elizabeth Warren, Democrat of Massachusetts, chastised Mohela over the conduct described in the report. They wrote, "Our nation's public servants, members of the military, and first responders deserve far, far better." A Mohela spokesperson said the company has doled out $43.8 billion in PSLF loan forgiveness to more than 606,000 borrowers through January of this year. The company said it doesn't have the authority to process relief without authorization from the federal government, which can take a long time. Mohela denied it profited from any stalled applications. "That's nonsense," said Scott Buchanan, the executive director of the Student Loan Servicing Alliance, a trade group representing servicers. The report's second major allegation is something it characterizes as a call deflection scheme, which it says Mohela used to divert borrowers from getting help from customer service representatives. The guidance to divert people was part of the company's internal plan drafted last July for handling the return to repayment, according to the report. "What has happened here is a pattern and practice of greed," said Randy Weingarten, the president of the American Federation of Teachers. Mohela sees it differently. The company said ahead of the return to repayment, the education department anticipated a surge in calls and encouraged servicers to find ways to show borrowers how to handle problems on their own. The department confirmed it worked with servicers to outline strategies to help borrowers find answers to simple problems online rather than by phone. Trying to encourage people who can self-service online is exactly what we should be doing, Buchanan said. Congressional Democrats last week urged the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, an oversight arm of the federal government, to follow up on the allegations in the report. A spokesperson for the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau declined to comment.
University of Florida eliminates all DEI positions. The University of Florida announced Friday that it is eliminating all diversity, equity, and inclusion employee positions. This change announced through an emailed administrative memo comes after Florida Board of Governors labeled expenditures related to DEI programs as prohibited expenditures. The memo explains that to comply with the Florida Board of Governors Regulation 9016 on prohibited expenditures, the University of Florida has closed the office of the Chief Diversity Officer, eliminated DEI positions and administrative appointments, and halted DEI-focused contracts with outside vendors. The Board of Governors defined DEI as any program, campus activity, or policy that classifies individuals on the basis of race, color, sex, national origin, gender identity, or sexual orientation, and promotes differential or preferential treatment of individuals on the basis of such classification. The regulation says a state university may not expend any state or federal funds to promote, support, or maintain any programs or campus activities that violate Section 1000.05 of Florida statutes, advocate for what it defines as diversity, equity, and inclusion, or promote or engage in what it defines as political or social activism. Florida Statute Section 1000.05, named the Florida Educational Equity Act, requires equality of access and prohibits discrimination on the basis of race, color, national origin, sex, disability, religion, or marital status against students and employees in the Florida K through 20 public education system. On Friday afternoon, Governor Ron DeSantis commented on X, formerly Twitter, "DEI is toxic and it has no place in our public universities. I'm glad that Florida was the first state to eliminate DEI, and I hope more states follow suit. Employees who have been fired will receive the university's standard 12-week of pay under the direction of UF Human Services. UF said these employees are encouraged to apply between March 1 and April 19 for expedited consideration for different positions currently open at the university. UF also said it will work to speed up the interview process for these employees and provide an answer on all applications within 12 weeks. Democratic State Representative Diane Hart and Yvonne Hinson voiced their disapproval of the firings. "I am stunned but not surprised at the elimination of DEI staff at University of Florida, my alma mater," Hinson said. "The culture was engaged in the Republican-dominated Florida House of Representatives will continue until Floridians have had enough and developed the will and determination to flip the majority in the Florida House." Hart called the series of firings the most recent manifestation of the policies of an out-of-touch legislation and a governor's failed presidential bid. When will we stop with these made-up culture wars that are literally costing people their livelihood? In an effort to prevent indoctrination in our classrooms, we have, in turn, created an education system that is built off lies, falsehoods, and deceptive history. We can't call ourselves the free state of Florida when children aren't free to learn the truth of their history and see the diversity of humanity. The Office of the Chief Financial Officer will reallocate approximately $5 million into a faculty recruitment fund to be administered by the Office of the Provost. These funds were previously reported to Tallahassee for DEI expenses, including employee salaries and expenditures. UF's diversity dashboard recorded that between fall 2012 and fall 2022, nearly half of students enrolled at the university have been white. In 2012, white students represented 56.11% out of 28,102 students, and in 2022, they represented 49.80% out of 30,278 students. In 2012, white faculty represented 73.61% of 3,341 employees, and in 2022, they represented 64.46% of 3,700 employees. White staff in 2012 represented 69.96% of 6,113 employees, and in 2022, they represented 63.32% of 6,709 employees. The memo said UF is and always will be unwavering in our commitment to universal human dignity.
Next in the front section, turning to the situation in the Middle East, Netanyahu rival makes trip to Washington. It's accompanied by a photograph of U.S. Air Force plane being loaded with food and water destined for an airdrop over Gaza. A top Israeli cabinet minister and longtime rival of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu arrived in Washington on Sunday for controversial meetings with Vice President Kamala Harris and other top U.S. officials. Benny Gantz, a centrist who joined Netanyahu's hardline government following Hamas's October 7th attack, comes amid deep disagreements between Netanyahu and President Joe Biden over the Israeli military's conduct in Gaza and a post-war vision for the enclave. Netanyahu instructed the Israeli embassy in the U.S. to withhold assistance in arranging the meetings, Israel Hayom reported. Israeli lawmaker and Netanyahu supporter David Amsalem was among those attacking Gantz on social media, accusing him of being a Trojan horse who joined Netanyahu's government to undermine it. Amsalem said, "You entered the emergency government to create a consensus during the war, not to stop the Israeli military from winning the war and create an opportunity to lead the process of establishing a Palestinian state that will eliminate the State of Israel." Harris is expected to discuss the urgency of a hostage deal and ceasefire, as well as the American commitment to increasing the flow of aid to Gaza, a White House official told the New York Times. Harris also plans to impress upon Gantz that the number of civilian casualties must be reduced and to express concern for more than 1 million displaced Palestinians in Rafah ahead of Israel's plan to deploy ground forces there, the Times said. Hopes for a ceasefire agreement in Gaza took another setback Sunday when Israel refused to send a negotiating team to Cairo, citing Hamas's refusal to release the names of hostages who are still alive. Representatives from Hamas, Qatar, and the U.S. are in Cairo for the talks. Multiple Israeli news outlets, including the Jerusalem Post, were reporting that the Israel delegation will not make the journey until the list is provided and other details of Hamas demands, including the health status of the hostages, are revealed. Israel also wants to know how many Israel-held prisoners would be freed for every hostage released under any deal. Biden has been bullish on a deal, saying last week he hoped an agreement could be reached ahead of Ramadan. The Muslim holy month begins in a week. Israel has said that more than 30 of the 130 remaining hostages held since the war began are dead. The first phase of the deal in the works reportedly called for the release of 40 hostages, including women, children, the elderly, and the sick, in the course of a six-week truce. About 400 Palestinian prisoners would be freed by Israel. Hamas will make no deal without Israel agreeing to end the war in Gaza, or at least providing a path to end the war, CNN reported, citing a highly placed source in the militant group. That could be a deal breaker. Netanyahu has repeatedly said Israel won't end the war until Hamas has been eliminated. Hamas-led militants stormed into southern Israel in a surprise attack on October 7th, rampaging through communities, killing some 1,200 people, mostly civilians, and taking around 250 hostages, including children and a newborn. More than 100 hostages were released during a one-week truce in November in exchange for 240 Palestinian prisoners. Israel's ensuing war has killed over 30,000 Palestinians, according to Gaza's health ministry, which does not differentiate between civilians and combatants in its tallies. Around 80% of Gaza's population of 2.3 million have fled their homes, and a quarter of the population faces starvation. The Israeli military said Sunday it has completed a two-week raid in Gaza City's Zaytun neighborhood, destroying Hamas and Palestinian Islamic Jihad sites and killing more than 100 operatives. On Sunday, Israeli Defense Minister Yoav Gallant visited troops in the Khan Yunis area of southern Gaza, calling progress on the ground impressive and pledging not to retreat from Gaza until Hamas has been dismantled. Israel claims to have killed over 10,000 Hamas fighters but has not provided evidence. Meanwhile, the Israeli military said it is stepping up efforts at providing humanitarian aid in Gaza, creating humanitarian corridors, establishing humanitarian pauses, and exercising caution in its use of force. The military said it has coordinated 21 airdrops of 450 packages in Gaza in collaboration with France, the UAE, Jordan, Egypt, and the U.S. Also Sunday, 50 incubators were shipped into Gaza, bound for five hospitals facing desperate shortages and overwhelming patient loads. A report last week indicated babies in some hospitals had to share incubators. We will continue expanding our humanitarian efforts to the civilian population in Gaza while we fulfill our goals of freeing our hostages from Hamas and freeing Gaza from Hamas, the military said in a statement. U.S. Air Force C-130 cargo planes, along with Jordan's Air Force, conducted airdrops of humanitarian aid into Gaza for 2 hours on Saturday, according to U.S. Central Command. The planes dropped over 38,000 meals along the coastline of Gaza, days after over 100 Palestinians were killed when witnesses said Israeli forces fired at people waiting for food in Gaza City. The Pentagon is planning for future airborne aid drops, according to a statement from Central Command. The parachute-borne packages have been packed so that they can be dropped safely in populated areas. However, humanitarian group officials have said airdrops aren't an efficient way to distribute aid and are a measure of last resort. Biden announced Friday that the airdrops would begin, saying the U.S. would join Jordan and other countries to provide the airdrops of supplies and would look to open up other avenues for delivering support.
Truth Social co-founders sue Trump in Delaware. The founders of Truth Social, a social media platform branded for former President Donald Trump, have sued the company they helped create in Delaware's Court of Chancery. That lawsuit is sealed for now, but in an associated motion to expedite the proceedings, attorneys for Trump Media co-founders Andy Litinsky and Wes Moss outline claims that the former president and his associates at Trump Media and Technology Group Corporation tried to cheat them out of the value of their shares in the company. Litinsky and Moss, whose partnership is called United Atlantic Ventures, met Trump on his former television show, The Apprentice. In 2021, they pitched Trump the idea of Truth Social and parent company Trump Media after Trump had been banned from other social media platforms. The company was incorporated in Delaware in 2021. In the filing, they say they organized the company without charging any fees while retaining a percentage of share of the company. Trump got 90% of the company. Moss and Litinsky together got 8.6%, according to legal filings. But as Truth Social prepares to merge with an acquisition company called Digital World Acquisition and go public, those shares stand to be worth a princely sum of money. The basis for the lawsuit filed Wednesday will be familiar to fans of lightly fictionalized Mark Zuckerberg biopic, The Social Network. Trump and his associates stand accused of diluting the value of the co-founders' shares by issuing a large number of new shares, which is in part what happened to both real and fictional Facebook co-founder Eduardo Severin. In recent weeks, Trump controlled TMTG, purported to increase the amount of its authorized stock from 120 million to 1 billion common shares and create new classes of voting, a non-voting stock, the billionaire share authorization, reads the motion from Moss and Litinsky attorneys. This wrongful 11th hour pre-merger corporate maneuvering can serve only one purpose, to dilute UAV before the merger and misappropriate UAV's merger consideration for Trump. Legal filings asking for an expedited court hearing allege violations of Delaware law in the handling of this alleged share dilution. Attorneys ask for the Court of Chancery to move quickly, in part because mingling Moss and Litinsky's shares with Trump incurs significant legal and financial jeopardy. The attorneys point out that the former president is already subject to $500 million in court judgments, including from the state of New York, making shares and money more difficult to claw back. The closing date on the Digital World Acquisition merger, March 22nd, approximately coincides with the March 25 deadline set for the state of New York for Trump to put up a $450 million bond that would allow him to appeal a civil fraud ruling. The merger represents a potential and perhaps existential liquidity event for Trump, which may explain his last-minute stock grab, the filing says. Trump representatives had not responded to the filings as of Thursday.
The time to spring forward is approaching. This by Victoria Fraley of the USA Today Network. The most painful night of the year is almost here. The start of daylight saving time, which subtracts an hour of sleep, is fast approaching. The seasonal time change when we spring forward will occur on March 10th, more than a full week before the official start of spring on March 20th. Daylight savings time begins at 2 a.m. when local time will instantly become 3 a.m. Most phones and computers adjust automatically, but manual clocks need to be reset. It's also a good time to change the batteries in your smoke alarm. Since 2007, daylight saving time has begun on the second Sunday of March and ended on the first Sunday of November. Previously, it started on the last Sunday of April and ended on the last Sunday of October. Excuse me. when daylight saving time begins. We spring forward and lose an hour of sleep, as opposed to the November time change, where we fall back and gain an hour. The adjustment affects the daily lives of hundreds of millions of Americans, contributing to less sleep in the days following, and of course, later sunsets. And yes, the phrase is daylight saving time, not savings or savings. It's singular, no matter how people around you say it. Contrary to popular myth, daylight saving time was not started to help American farmers. According to timeanddate.com, daylight saving time was first used in 1908 by a few hundred Canadians in Thunder Bay, Ontario. Germany popularized daylight saving time after it first set the clocks forward on April 30, 1916, to save coal during World War I. Daylight saving time became a national standard in 1966 when President Lyndon B. Johnson signed the Uniform Time Act, which was established as a way to conserve energy. The thinking was, if it's light out longer, that's less time you'll need to use the lights in your house. Presently, Hawaii and Arizona are the only two U.S. states that do not observe daylight saving time. Neither do the U.S. territories of Puerto Rico, Virgin Islands, Guam, American Samoa, and Northern Mariana Islands. However, daylight saving time is now used in more than 70 countries worldwide and affects over 1 billion people every year. The beginning and end dates vary from one country to another. Setting aside the deep philosophical question, the U.S. Department of Transportation is in charge of daylight saving time and all time zones in the U.S. The oversight of time zones was assigned to DOT because time standards are important for many modes of transportation, the department's website says. Recent years have seen a public debate over discontinuing daylight saving time. The U.S. Senate unanimously approved the Sunshine Protection Act in 2022, a bill that would make daylight saving time permanent. However, it did not pass in the U.S. House of Representatives, so the ritual version of the clock the ritual of changing the clock remains. A 2023 version of the bill remained idle in Congress as well. We are close to our time for a short break and some birthday announcements. So, just a reminder that you're listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service.